All right. Thank you so much. Now, when you do an education talk, it's always difficult to pick an image, right? Because in physics, you sort of have a nice maybe result or some sort of apparatus. So you've got here our new state-of-the-art classroom. That's one choice. You know, here you've got learning when it's working. And then the other side of that, right? What I chose to do was kind of a gimmick, right? So what I'm going to talk about today are some of the things I do in my second year quantum mechanics course. And one of the things I use is a technique called just-in-time teaching. And a big component of that is the pre-class quiz. And so I thought it would be nice, you know, first of all, to give you guys kind of a flavor for how that works. But also to sort of show you how I use this. And so the actual responses you gave me, I'm going to use to guide this talk, right? And so one of the questions on this quiz I gave out, and again, of course, you know, you can always check it out at some later time if you haven't had a chance to see it yet. But is there anything about your courses that you think could be improved? And I just should say I was really happy with the response. I got more than 60 responses. About maybe a little bit less than half were faculty, and then half were students, roughly, and a few extras in there. And most people, I think, at least self-identified, most people took it serious, which is great. And I got a really, a lot of really good questions. So here, is there anything about your course that you think could be improved? So I want my students to learn physics efficiently while also learning to think more like a physicist. More involvement from students, less one-sidedness to the lectures. Designing assignments to promote inquiry, good guessing, deeper understanding. Engage fourth-year students more. Have less math, more physics in my graduate courses. Okay, so these are all, I think, really, you know, and some of these are, you know, some people had similar questions too. We also asked, what questions do you have about physics education research? I'll spend some time talking a little bit about this too. Some really great questions. You know, how do we improve the buy-in from students? How do I get students to read the material before class discussion on that material? That's a really key question. How do you distinguish between good teaching and crowd-pleasing? Getting good student evaluations by being easy or entertaining? This is a good one, too. Is there a short, handy summary somewhere about PER? And then, is there any rigorous proof for the benefits of PER? So, again, I think a lot of people had similar thoughts. Hopefully, if you didn't get a chance to do this, you know, even some of your questions are in here. But I'm going to try to address most of these somewhere in my talk. And that's how, you know, this just-in-time teaching works. And we'll get to that later. Okay, so I would say that I think answers to a lot of these questions can be found in the physics education community. For the past 30 years, physicists have taken up... So this started with people who were trained physicists and wanted to figure out better ways to teach physics. So it's been going on for a while. There's a lot of different things you can do. This is some of the bigger groups that they have. Now, my definition of this, when I think about PER, I think that this is how it works for me. So you devise a new teaching tool based on known student difficulties in learning physics. Then you test these tools. This is key. You test these tools and figure out which ones work. And I think that's sort of the key. And then you repeat. And you try to do this over and over, right? The idea is, at least in my mind, you're never really done getting better at this, okay? This is I think teaching is a really hard thing. And so especially trying to quantify teaching. And so just maybe a nice definition is the application of the scientific method to teaching and learning of physics. I think, you know, a lot of times you'll have someone say, you know, this worked for me, and I think this is really great. And maybe it is great, but with PER, what I think they're trying to do, what we're trying to do is quantify this, if at all possible, okay? Try to come up with ways to actually see if this really does work. It may have been a self-select bunch that answered my quiz, but about half of the people who answered were in A or B. In fact, exactly half. It was kind of creepy. So either I'm very familiar with this field, that was about 20%, or I've used some techniques or seen them before. And so I do think PER is getting out there and people at least know about it a little bit. So just today, my goal, so I'm just going to talk to you about some of the things that I'm doing in my Physics 256. Again, this is a second semester or second year quantum physics course, and it's roughly half modern physics, like photoelectric effect, things like this, and half wave mechanics, you know, Hamiltonians, time-dependent Schrodinger equations, scattering, this kind of a thing. But what I also want to do is provide a roadmap, if you will, or maybe some useful tips for those of you who are interested in this kind of stuff, but maybe aren't sure how to do it. Okay? So just a little bit about my perspective again. So I was an undergraduate at the University of Illinois, and this is where I learned about PER. And so I was there at a time when they were overhauling their first-year courses to incorporate PER research-based techniques. And they were sort of brought into this in a way that many people were. They were threatened. So the physics department or the engineering department basically threatened to take away the engineering first-year course, which was the bread and butter of the physics department, if they didn't shape up. And so I was actually able to come in and, you know, sort of help behind the scenes working on developing materials and things like this. And so just to let you know where I'm coming from, I sort of think of myself more as a PER user than an expert. Okay, I think of myself as an instructor first. When I go to these PER conferences, I'm thinking, what can help me in the classroom? Okay, that's really my number one goal. And the other thing, it's kind of curious, when I started, even though I was well aware of these techniques from my experience as an undergraduate, when I started teaching, I did very traditional lectures. Okay, so I think I really understand where, you know, the reticence to start this comes from, because I was the same way myself. And so what I've done is I sort of have sprinkled in little bits of PER along the way as I've developed as an instructor. All right, so let's go to some of your questions. So here's a nice one. You know, how do we distinguish between good teaching and crowd-pleasing, getting good student evaluations by being easy or entertaining? Anybody have any thoughts on this? Okay.
You can look at how they do the next year in the follow-up course.
Oh, okay, yeah. You can see how they do in the follow-up courses. That's a great metric, you know. Any other ideas? I mean, basically you're trying to find metrics that you can measure how the course is going. That's a great one. Any other thoughts? Yeah. Exactly. That's basically what they've done primarily. Okay? Now, I'm not going to say that I have all the answers to measuring the successful teaching, because that's very difficult. Okay, and I think nobody really does. People are still working on this. But for me, and I think for a lot of PER, it's based on, as John was saying, it's research-based surveys. All right, and so the most famous one you've probably heard about is the FCI. It's given to first-year people who are doing mechanics. And the way this works is you give them a pre-test and a post-test, and you look at the difference. And this difference, you know, they call this the gain. And, you know, I'm not sure if I'm going to say this is a measure of what they've learned, but it's a metric to help you see how successful they have been. And at this point, physics was one of the first of the discipline-based education groups or fields to pop up. And so at this point, there's one of these tests for many, many things that we teach. In fact, I've always been able to find one for every class that I've taught. And so there's a lot of them out there, and this, to me, you know, most of the surveys and results you'll see are somehow based on something like this. So they're developed from research, they're standardized, they're tested, and I mean, the FCI has just been done so much, it's almost to the point where it's not useful anymore. And so the idea is to sort of look at where students are having difficulties and really kind of try to test this. Now, I think that question also alluded to this. You know, are course evaluations useful? That's another difficult question. I think they're useful. I know for me, you know, a lot of the big changes I've made in my course have come from course evaluations, right? So I think they're very useful. I think when I look at mine, most of the students seem to be, you know, even the critical ones, you know, trying to help. So I think they're great. I think they're useful. But, you know, if I have a course that has great evaluations, but this isn't so good, you know, I'm worried. I don't think that that's successful. Okay, I'm going to be trying to fix things. So I think that's important, at least for me. Okay, here's a kind of a longer one, but kind of a good one. Is there any rigorous proof for the benefits of PER? Many of the studies that are often used to show the improvements from PER are very poorly designed. Hopefully it wasn't someone that saw something I was doing. and broadly suffer from either a very small sample size or insufficient analysis of confounding variables that might provide an alternate explanation of the result. All right, so I think what they're kind of saying is, what does all this PER stuff really mean, right? And, well, here's my answer. Now, I'm being a little bit funny here, but I feel your pain, okay? I mean, as physicists, I think we're used to results that are easier to quantify, easier to sort of look at. You're right. You can't really control a lot of these experiments. I'll see people at PR conferences saying things like, this person, such and such, proved this in their paper last year. And I'll think, what? That's one paper. It was 20 people in the sample size. It's like you can't, but I do think when you get a large amount of proof and evidence, okay, we can start to at least begin to make conclusions, right? And so this came out a couple of years ago, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, and this is a meta-analysis of 225 studies that looked at, that were comparing some sort of interactive engagement versus a control group that was doing more of a traditional lecture. And their conclusion was that the active learning increased the student performance, and this is in the STEM fields. This could be a number of fields in this. And so to me, this is where you start to get, I think, some conclusions that you can at least talk about as being substantial, right? And so this study came out, I think the improvement in scores, so these were based on either research-based surveys or exams, and the scores were a half of a standard deviation better for the active learning people. If you were in the traditional lecture, you had 1.5 more chance of either failing or dropping the course. And it's interesting, the people who do this are biomedical people, and so it's sort of comparing apples and oranges, but they made the point that if this was a medical study comparing some drug to a placebo, it may have been stopped, okay, because it would have been unethical to keep giving people the placebo, all right? So, and also, I think when you look at some of the bigger physics studies, okay, they are even, I think, more substantial. So at this point, I think everyone in the PR community is really on board with the fact that interactive teaching is better. Of course, there's always a few holdouts, right? You can't please everybody. The best part here is you really have no idea if this is real or not. Okay, so now one thing I want to talk about are the barriers to using these tools. Again, I know what it's like. So this is your answers again. Why, if you haven't used these techniques, are you hesitant to do so? So again, a lot of people answered, but they kind of came into these same camps. So I don't know enough about the effective techniques. The extra workload on the instructor and the TAs, okay, that's a big concern. Cultural resistance from the students. Are the students going to dislike having to do all these extra bells and whistles and things? Haven't thought about how they apply to the upper year class I'm teaching now. This one's a good one, too. I'm afraid I'll put in a lot of time and it won't work. Really, I think that kind of says it all. And so we can look at research. So this is a big problem, right? PR community is really upset by this. They've been doing this for 30 years, and it hasn't spread, like they hoped. And this has been shown, a lot in a lot of studies. Now, here's one. Charles Henderson is someone who's looked at this a lot, and he broke down, this is sort of the process you go through when you're trying to innovate or add some of these techniques to your course. So the first thing is a knowledge that they're out there, right? The second thing is the motivation to do that. And then the third is actually doing it, okay? Implementing it in your course. And then the fourth is continuing to do this, okay, after the first time. And what he's found is that his research suggests that the first two steps are working pretty well, right? Most people know this is out there. They know what a clicker is. They know what these things can do, or at least what people say they can do. I think there are people who are motivated, but it's either getting them to do it, or, and what's maybe more important, keeping them doing it. Okay, the bottleneck seems to be there. So when I'm thinking about a talk like this, you know, you've had people come in here much more versed in the literature than me, telling you why this works, how this works, showing data. You've seen this before. I'm not interested in going over that. I'm interested in trying to help, okay, get us through these steps here. And just more recent stuff from Stephanie Chasteen here seems to indicate that the best success occurs when there is some sort of departmental or institutional support. Okay, even here, we underwent, you know, before my time, but they underwent a big renovation in the first year physics courses, 131, 132. They built brand new classrooms. There was given release time to instructors to come up with materials and things like that. What they're sort of seeing now is that without this sort of support, it's very difficult for these things to be implemented and to be continued. And so this is what I'm interested in, is sort of helping this along. UC Boulder is probably one of the most developed as far as having PER in their upper level courses. And this came from the department. It was department led. It wasn't, you know, one or two individuals saying, hey, let's try this. It was a department decision. And so I think these are the kind of things that will be useful for this kind of thing, right? And so where to get help? Well, you know, for me, these are the ways that I've been supported, or at least can think about being supported, in trying to do this, right? So first thing is building the course infrastructure. Right now, 131, 132, there's a huge amount of infrastructure. You can just sort of come in and start using it, okay? You don't really need to develop much yourself. You know, in the 256 course I'm doing, if you wanted to take that over and use some of my materials, there's a good amount of infrastructure to use. There's also different places that, you know, everything, this is my secret, almost everything in my 256 course was stolen, or, you know, maybe borrowed is a better word, you know. So they're developing these things and they want you to use them. I also think, you know, extra TA time, there's a lot of TAs who are really interested and willing to be involved in this kind of stuff. And I've gone, you know, having an office next to Pierre can be really helpful. Okay, he can find extra TAs and extra TA time. I also think just this idea of maybe, you know, co-teaching. You know, maybe you have a course you think it would be good to do this in, and what you could do is co-teach it with someone who has experience doing this. And, you know, this goes right along with, you know, support from the teaching faculty. You know, for my money, you know, I really consider it part of my job helping with this. I want to help with this. And even if it's just helping you find the resources, I'm really interested in doing this, okay? And so this is a question. So this is just-in-time teaching. This came in, I think, last night. So this is a, sort of along these same lines. You know, how much PER is applied at U of Toronto? And I started thinking about that. I know what I do. I know what we do in 131, 132, but there could be other things going on. I don't know. I mean, we should probably be talking about, or I should be talking about this with more people, I think. I think there is great support from the administration to help with this. And there are people in other departments. There's people in engineering, people in math, people in chemistry who are doing a lot of similar stuff. CTSI is a great resource. You know, but part of this talk for me is, you know, this question here, you know, how can we can encourage these conversations, encourage the development of this sort of thing here? Because I really think there is a bottleneck. Okay, now, anecdotally, for me, I've, again, been sort of sprinkling in these techniques slowly over time, and as I've done this, I've almost always improved my student satisfaction, improved my, that's one thing we don't talk about, is I'm much happier now, right? I mean, I don't know if you've ever been in the middle of a proof on the board, and you look back, and no one's watching, right? That is just the most depressing feeling in the world, right? And that happens a lot less to me now than it used to. And improved learning gains. Now, one key, so we had Eugenia Kina here last year, and she said it really great. She said that, you know, interactive techniques are the best way to enhance your learning gains, but they're not always going to work, right? You know, we've done things that we were really excited about and tried, and the gains are minimal. So, you know, I think you do need sometimes going back, looking over, trying to figure out what maybe you've done wrong, what could be improved. But for me, in general, you know, anecdotally, I've always had improvement. So maybe that's been encouraged. Maybe that's the difference. Maybe if my first try had gone horribly, I would just have given up, right? I don't know. Okay, so here's what I'd like to talk about today. So for the rest of the time. So just go into some of the things I'm doing in this 2-5-6. Now, one of the great things about this research that says interactiveness helps is there really isn't any indication that one is better than the other. Okay, there's a lot of different schools of thought of how to make classrooms more interactive. I think the things that I'm doing are great because they can be added to a traditional lecture pretty easily. You can take a traditional lecture and add just-in-time teaching and not really change too much. Okay, some of these different schools of thought are, you know, they're almost like religious cults, right? The people are really, this is the best way you have to do it, and in order to do it their way, you really have to tear everything down and build it up again. And maybe they're right, you know, but, you know, so the two of the things that I sort of built my teaching on is just-in-time teaching and peer instruction. Eric Mazur, using these, has gotten just as good learning gains as anything else that's out there. I think there's sort of a vision that maybe tearing it down and building it up again is the way to go, and maybe there's something to that, but I do think that the research shows that you can do just as well with these things, and I think it's easier to add these into your class. So the just-in-time teaching, which we've been sort of talking about, peer instruction, clicker questions, flipping the lecture, and then improving the tutorial time. And so these are the things I want to talk about. So the first thing, just-in-time teaching, I'm going to say JIT, that's kind of unfortunate, but just to save with the... And so this is the idea of what we've been doing so far. All right, so we asked this pre-class quiz. And so it's an approach where we have the students answer a few short essay questions about a new subject area. So the one thing we didn't really get with the pre-class quiz I gave you guys was you didn't have a reading. So the idea is you do a reading, and it's new material. You've never seen this before, okay? And I ask you questions about it. And the questions are hard questions, okay? They're not easy questions. They're tests, they're questions that could be on a test, okay? And we submit these online, just like I did. So I use Google Forms for mine. And just so you know, this was developed by physicists, PER people. Now it's used in many disciplines. So why use this? Well, I think, you know, one thing too I should probably say is that, you know, there's lots of reasons to use this, and you don't really have to go all in. You can kind of use it a little bit, and I think it'll help. And so for me, for my money, I think the just-in-time teaching is, if I was to say, what would I start with right away, I would say this. Okay, and so there's many benefits, and you don't really have to go all the way. So one thing is, it really, I think, helps students to structure their readings. Okay, and so this would answer the question, how do I get students to read the material before a class discussion on the material? So I'm asking the students to write a few sentences about what they think about what is a pretty hard question in physics. Okay, and so I really feel, okay, when you look at the answers, you'll see them in a little bit, that the students are reading the material. That doesn't mean they're getting it all, okay? But I really do think that they're reading it, and they're making it much easier than when we come into class time to sort of talk about these things, okay? And so it helps them to structure their readings. It also helps to reveal where the students are having issues, so you can build what I would call a tighter lecture, okay? Clearing time for interactive activities. Now, I know people who basically use it to do this, okay? And don't do so much of this, and that's fine. I think it's still useful. But sort of like what I've done today, right? So I took some questions that you guys asked, and I'm sort of focusing on those, and then maybe putting some other things that I wanted to talk about in the back, thinking, well, that's not really a big thing for us today. Okay, and so this is more involvement from the students and less one-sidedness to the lectures. And so finally, I think the students feel they are part of the teaching process. Okay, I get that a lot, all right? And so you will literally address their questions in class, and especially in the, you know, 1,000-person classroom, you know, you'll sort of see them, they won't believe it, right? That's my question up there. And so I think that really helps to sort of improve the buy-in from the students. And so the just-in-time part is this idea, okay, is that sort of I sort of collect their questions and can sort of fix my lecture just in time. Like I was adjusting things in this talk just an hour ago looking at some of the questions I got from you guys. And so that's, I think, kind of the philosophy there. So for me, in my physics course, again, this is quantum mechanics, quantum physics. So these questions are due 8 a.m. the morning of each lecture. And it's roughly the length of what you guys did. These include a reading assignment that involves new material. And again, these are questions that try to approach common student difficulties. And what's really important here is that the assignment is marked on effort. Okay? And I use the Google Forms. People use different things. There's things you can use that cost money. One big advantage of this is it's free for the students. And so nobody has to pay for anything, and it's super convenient. I've checked my pre-class quizzes at Starbucks before, right, on my phone, and so it's really handy. Now, one thing I really want to sort of stress is that this is not a reading test. So they've had these things, reading tests in physics, and this is a question that's usually given 4 points. And so it's, you know, they sort of say, they're grading on accuracy, and it's usually pretty easy. You know, sometimes, like, you know, what is momentum? And they'll have sort of 4 definitions. And the thing is with the students, it's really easy, you know, to just sort of page through and find momentum and answer the question and not really do the reading. Okay, so I think for this to work, it has to be, number one, open-ended, more difficult, and something that aims at something that you know they're going to have trouble with. And graded on effort. So I don't care if they're 100% wrong, as long as they write a few sentences that prove to me that they're thinking about this. Okay? So here's an example of a question that I ask in my 256 course. And so this is, we've just solved the infinite square well, and so I'm not going to test you on this or anything. But this, I think, is a pretty difficult question. You know, I did pretty well in my undergrad quantum, and I'm not sure how I would have done on this question. You know, so one thing about these is they get to the more conceptual understanding. And so we're asking them, does the wave function A sine squared of pi x divided by A, is that an acceptable wave function? And we give a couple of reasons why it is or it isn't. And again, these are developed by Chandrasekhar Singh at the University of Pittsburgh. And so, you know, they've really looked at where people have issues. And I think this idea, you've just solved for the eigenstates of this, and you've read that you can sum them up to equal other functions, but connecting that, I think, can be tricky. And so this is something that, so the answer, I'll just give it to you here. But I would call that a difficult question. So this is just my results from doing it this year. You can see that we're lucky that the number one answer actually is the correct answer, so that's nice. But it's definitely not easy. There's a lot of questions on that. And sort of a key part is so I can see their answer, but here is where I want them to explain to me what they're thinking. And I'm not sure how well you can see this, but you know, they're writing a couple sentences about the physics. Okay, they're really proving to me that they've thought about this. And it's, to me, it's just been amazing. You know, when I look at these, you know, maybe 1-3% of them look like they're not reading. They'll say something like, I don't know, or whatever, right? But the rest of them, I mean, I guess I can't say they're reading, but they're definitely thinking about this. And so to me, it's been really great. And when I talk to them, it really does seem like they're doing the reading. And it just makes coming to class much easier. I typically, at the end, ask a question like this. Did you have any questions from the reading? And this is great, too. So I asked you guys this, too, you know, something like this, at least. And so here you can kind of see, you know, so here you're saying, what exactly does it mean for psi n to be complete? Okay, that's a great question. It's one of those things that maybe, you know, you don't realize from when you learned this that might be something they're curious about. You know, they'll say, where does equation 2.37 come from? How do we go about physically interpreting all of this stuff? You know, so they ask, I mean, I'm just amazed at the questions we get. They're just really great questions, and they're super helpful, again, in directing the lecture. And, you know, you don't get too many of them, but I think it's kind of like this thing, you know. So I showed you guys the responses from other people, and I bet you probably have a lot of the same feelings. Well, I think the students have the same sort of feedback loop. And so this leads just to teaching truth. So there's a couple things in teaching that I kind of hold to, and this is from a great 21st century philosopher. And so, you know, I think, you know, this whole idea of just-in-time teaching, right? You know, when I was in class, people said, hey, read this chapter, and I never did, okay? Because there was no accountability for it, right? And you could say I'm a horrible human being, right? But I sort of think that I'm just a human being, right? I've got other things going on, and it's hard to read physics texts, especially when you're brand new at it, right? And so having some of this that kind of directs you and kind of sort of keeps you on, I think, is just sort of, you know, to me, it goes along with human nature, okay? And that's, again, thank you for that quote. Okay, so how much time will this take? So you'll see this will be kind of a trend here. It takes less time than you'd think. Okay, so again, I think this is the thing I would suggest doing if you had sort of a, you know, if you're sort of thinking about what to start right away. I think this this saves you time in the long run, right? I mean, if you do this, you're going to be answering these questions later in office hours or in emails or whatever. So I think it really helps everybody. And this is the number one question I get, right? So do you read all of these answers, right? Of course I don't. Right? But I try to read them, most of them all the time, right? I don't always get to them. I mean, there are days where you're just too busy, you don't get to it, but they're still reading and still answering it, okay? And I mean, I would say I read most of them, but, the good news is I don't think you necessarily have to, especially after you've done the course once or twice, you kind of know what the questions are going to be, so that's really helpful. And so here you get a nice little Excel spreadsheet when I do the Google Forms. And so what I do is I'll just sort of scroll through here and look for people who didn't seem like they were thinking, okay? And then I just take their points away. right? And so, I mean, I would say most of the time I go through most of these and get sort of great questions from them. But once you've done it a few years, you kind of sort of see what they're going to say. All right. So the next thing, which I think for a lot of people goes with this, is peer instruction. And of course, the name you hear from this is Eric Mazur, and this is basically clicker questions. So this is a pedagogical approach that promotes classroom learning to engage students and address difficult aspects of the material. All right, and so why is this helpful? Well, first of all, it promotes active learning, and so what this means is during my class, somewhere between 5 or 10 times, I stop class and ask them a difficult multiple choice question. I'll show you some examples in a second, and they're allowed to discuss amongst themselves. And I think I try to aim that they're doing this, that we spend time doing this, roughly 40-50% of the lecture, something like that. It's not a perfect number, but that's sort of what I think a good number to aim for. And so it's very active. They stop. They talk about physics. It facilitates social learning. So I think that sort of helps us with both of these two questions or concerns we had in the quiz. So I use clickers. My courses are pretty big, you know. My small course is 150, right? And so you have this electronic device. But what's really nice is if I teach a course of about 50 or so, I use these things, okay? And so these things are really easy to use. And I thought we would just try to use one. So here's a clicker question. You can try it on for yourself. And so basically, you take this and you show me what answer you want. So if you think the answer is A, just put up an A. So let's go ahead and answer this one here. So what does the I in I clicker stand for? Anybody know? Okay, so I'm getting, well, now first of all, just for like a helpful hint, okay, what you're supposed to do at this point, if you're doing this with these cards, because the important thing is that people are doing this, and that everyone's doing it, is you need to yell at the people not doing it. Hey. But that's just a tip, okay, when you're doing this, if you don't yell at people the first couple times, they know you're not really watching. And they don't do it. And so you have to go kind of yell at people. Now, I'm getting 100% D's, okay? So now here's one thing you do with this sort of a question and say, okay, let's back up. The answer is either B or D. What do you think now? So now I answer again. It's B. So, yeah. So these were developed at the University of Illinois. And so that's where the I, and it was done before iClicker came, or before iPads and iPods or anything. So I think they sort of got in before Apple owned the letter I. Yeah. Well, you know, that's fine. Yeah. But anyway, that's how you would do that. And I just kind of wanted to kind of show you, because I think for a lot of our upper level courses, these cards will work just as fine. In fact, there's people who use these cards in 1,000-person classrooms, okay? And they're people who are really good at yelling, right? but they do it, and they say that it's actually better. So it's I think it's about the same, but if you've got a smaller class like that, that's a nice way of doing it without the sort of buy-in. So here's an example of some of the clicker questions that I do in 2, 5, 6. So here we have we're talking about the harmonic oscillator. We've got a superposition of the first two eigenstates, and so we're asking questions about the expectation value of the position, the momentum, and the energy, which one of them depends on time. Again, you know, for someone starting out in this, I don't think that's a very easy question. And so we give this to the class, and they think about it. Usually I'll give it to them as a pre-class quiz and let them think about it there. Here's one, too, that, you know, this is one I'm happy about. This is actually one I developed, so that's exciting. But we have this issue when you're doing raising and lowering operators where people will apply the raising operator on here, and they'll want to raise the energy, okay? And so it's really good to, you know, to address this right away. So when we introduce this, I'll put this question up, and you won't believe the discussion you get from this, right? I mean, they really discuss this a lot. And of course, you know, I hope that at least helps them to sort of see, and then I'll stop and sort of explain where this is coming from. This one usually is like almost 50-50 tie when you mark this one. So how much time will this take? Well, again, you know, my routine takes less time than you'd think. So here's just some tips for doing this, okay, because I know, you know, the implementation is the difficult part. So first of all, I spend the entire first lecture, okay, I burn a whole lecture talking about what I do, why I do, and why I believe in it, okay, and I think that is really important. Now, if you just start doing this without telling them why you're doing it or how important it is to you, I think it's kind of setting yourself up to fail. I also think, just like what I did in 2, 5, 6, is try to find good questions from colleagues, from the research community. Ask one of us to point you in the right direction, okay? But I really think, you know, I have seen people try peer instruction and have it backfire. And when I've seen it backfire, it's because they're either asking questions that are too easy, so the students are like, why are we bothering with this? Or they don't ask enough. And so the students feel like you're just basically taking attendance or something. Okay, so I think you need to have questions that are challenging, that really, you know, are going to get good conversation going, and you need to, I would say, commit to doing this. Okay, you really need to sort of make sure that you sort of jump in and don't just, you know, if they sense that you're just taking attendance, which I don't think we're going to do that with this, but if they sense that, they won't be happy. So you got to really invest in this here. So just, again, some of my tips, and of course, all of us, I think, are here to help you if you have questions about this. So just the last two things I'll spend not too much time on, but something that I've been doing recently is this idea of the flipped lecture. And this is where what I do is I make a pre-class video. So I make a little video, I'll sort of tell you more about how I do that. And so the students sort of have the choice. They can do the reading, they can watch my video, they can do both. And so this is good because then class time can even be better spent, you know, working on some of the more conceptual and quantitative exercises that trouble them in discussing things, and less time, you know, with me talking to them about something or going through a proof or something like that. So for me, you know, why do we do this? Well, it gives a chance to sort of cover some basic material in this video. So I think there are people now that'll say, you know, if you've got a proof, do the proof in the video. You know, if you think it's a really important proof, have them do it in their discussion time, or have them do it for a homework problem, right? And that'll ease this boredom, right? This turning around and seeing the classroom, you know, all asleep. It also gives us more time to focus on student difficulties. Often with some proof, there's, you know, one or two steps they haven't seen before. I can focus more on that and leave the other steps to this video. So it's just more of this. Again, the idea with the flipped classroom is they do more of the traditional lecture activities at home, and then in class we can do more of higher level sort of ideas. Now, how much time will these videos take? Well, of course, you know exactly, right? So I'm not going to lie to you here. These things can take a lot of time, all right? But what's great is if this is a class that you know you're going to do a lot, okay, once you do it, it's there forever, as long as you don't sort of tie it to a textbook too tightly. Okay, I have videos that I made 5 years ago that I'm still using. Okay, and so I think this can be really tricky. And so just some advice here. So what I do is I try to make this as simple as possible, just simple screen capture software. Camtasia is the one you can pay for. I use Cam Studio, the freeware version, and so I just literally capture the screen. And I do it kind of, if you're familiar with Khan Academy, I sort of draw, and you know, I'll sort of go over some examples, maybe some proofs, some of the finer points of the discussion. I try to keep these videos to about 20 minutes. I post them on YouTube, and I think the best advice I ever got with these is, you know, don't try for perfection. I'll be in my office working on these things, and as long as I don't literally say something false, right, I'll usually go with it, okay? And so it's not necessarily going to be the best, but, you know, I get very few complaints. And so with YouTube, you get the chance to actually track your views, right? And so me and Jason have been doing this at 131, and I think in 131, 132, if I get 50 or 60% of the class to watch it, if I get that number of views, I'm really happy, right? I think that's like a, but I did this in this 256 course, and I get somewhere between 1 and 1.5 times the class number of views before I actually do the lecture, which I was kind of astounded. You know, that, I mean, again, who knows exactly what a YouTube view is, but it seems like they're watching these, you know, for better or for worse. And so I think that can be really helpful. It is much more of a time suck, I think. And the last thing is, me and the TAs developed some tutorial exercises to work on during the tutorial. So I think the traditional tutorial here at U of T is, you know, the teaching assistant at the board sort of going over homework problems. And what we've done is we've sort of flipped that to where the people are working in groups, working on problems, and the TA is kind of going around facilitating, very similar to what we do in the practicals. And so with the TA's help, I think we were able to set these up pretty, you know, painlessly. But what I think what also is great is our tutorials are probably the size of some of your classes. If you have a 30-person class, I think that's a very nice size to actually sort of stop class and have them work on some sort of exercise, okay? And so I think this is something that, you know, for me, I think, you know, if I have a small class like that, I generally will do that. I think it can be really helpful. Okay, so just my results, and again, this is anecdotal. This is in my 256 course. So I would say I have good learning gains. Now, there's a survey here. Now, the problem is I'm sort of stuck between two. So I'm doing stuff in the second year course here in Canada that I think U.S. people generally do in the third and fourth year. So this wave mechanics. So this is what my learning survey covers, these things here. So they've given this to, you know, a large number, at least, you know, some of these aren't as well validated as others. But they've given this to people in the U.S., and the average being about 39%. So for us, in a second year, we only spend half the semester and don't even cover all of this stuff fully, are bettering that. Now, you know, I wish I had a control group to sort of look at this on, but I'm pretty happy with this, okay? And then student satisfaction, I would say, I've been really pleased with the student evaluation. So I had this person's worry. Okay, I sort of worried that maybe physics students, because we know we've had pretty good success in our non-majors course, but I was worried that maybe it wouldn't reflect. But, you know, I went sort of over my evaluations, and somewhere between 3% and 5% of the people will actually say something critical, like I don't like the clickers, or I think the pre-class quiz is too much work. But then there's approximately 50 to 60% that are actually, these are the people that actually make comments. And so I think, you know, with these online forums, I'm getting about 55% of the people are doing the evaluations, and some group less than that are actually answering, but about 50 or 60 are actually saying something very positive about these. And this is, you know, these, which are kind of my favorite ones. You know, this is sort of like the first chapter of the JIT book. Right, I was skeptical of the usefulness of clickers, especially given the cost, but the instructor effectively incorporated them in lectures in order to allow for group discussion. You know, so you get these almost like you've converted this person over to PER, right? And so I get far more of these than I get the ones, you know, I get just a handful of the other kind. Of course, no one knows what evaluations really mean anyways. You know, we're getting barely over 50% responding. But I've been pleased, and I would go so far as to say that I think this idea of there being resistance, you know, we get roughly the same resistance that we do for the 131 course, I would say. So I don't think there's anything more resistible about physics students with this. Okay, so just to end here, you know, just, you know, thanks. You know, keep in touch. I'd love to hear about things you're doing, you know, along these lines or along other lines. You know, I think one thing I've learned in sort of doing this is that we need to maybe have more communication. So I'd love to hear what you're doing. Whenever I talk to somebody about education, I always learn something. Okay, and I'd love to help with the resources. And so here's just some resources. This is where you might want to pull out your phone and take a picture. I'm sure maybe we can try to find a way to distribute this better. But this is just some of the resources out there. Now, unfortunately, I don't think there is a nice, short, handy summary. I sort of spent the last day and a half looking for this. I'm not sure if it's either A, the community isn't so good at that, or maybe it's just not easy to do a short, handy summary. I don't know. But this is the shortest, handiest summary I could find. Now, these two things are set up by the community with the resources on there. This one, I think, is they're just starting this up now, and so it's not even really complete yet, but I think this is going to be the best one you can go for. This here is sort of a conglomeration of everything that anyone's ever done in PER sort of put into a website, which is great, but it's also everything anyone's ever done in PER put into a website, so it's difficult to navigate, right? But I think the FISPort is going to be a good place. And of course, you know, the big thing is, you know, I think talking to us, you know, we're definitely, I'm willing to help with this. And just to leave you with something here, so this is just, you know, kind of motivation. So this is me before PER. All right, so, I mean, if this, look what it's done to me, imagine what this can do to you, okay? So I'll leave this up to take a picture of, and then we'll open up for any questions. Thank you. Yeah, I think the question is sort of, you know, so there's the discipline-based research, and then there is more just traditional education research. I think there's a lot of good connections. You know, if I write a paper, usually there's a good number of more psychological studies or education research that I'm citing. So I think there is a good connection. And you know, I get asked a lot, why do we even have PER research? And I think when you get to these advanced courses, to really help people, you need to have an understanding of the underlying physics, okay, to sort of try to tear apart what, you know, problem are the students having with this. You really need to kind of understand it pretty well. But I think there's a pretty good connection there. But you're right. I think we're lucky in physics in that this has been around for so long, and it's almost so well developed that it's difficult to navigate, I think, is the problem now. There's so much stuff out there, it's hard to know where to go. Other questions? Yeah. Okay, and this is the problem we have is sort of the two distribution, maybe the higher end and the middle of the road or something. But what's your exact question? It's just sort of, and that's the thing. So like the FCI, there's some people that don't like the FCI, right? I was looking at a paper yesterday, sort of reading up on this, and there's actually the quote, "Well, it's the best that we have," right? Which isn't great, but I do think it's a measure of something, and you got to start somewhere. It's been told to me, you know, do we really care how well these people understand Newtonian mechanics, right? Well, there's a lot of metrics to maybe even like the non-major course. I mean, there's so many different things you can kind of think about measuring your course on is, you know, how well they know Newtonian mechanics, is that, you know, important? And then there's the question of how well this is really measuring this, right? I think it measures it pretty well, okay? But the question, you know, how useful is knowing that, that's a different question, but again, like when I'm doing this, and I'm trying to look at, you know, improving these learning gains, you know, and so you sort of find the test that you think is nice, and you sort of focus on that one, and it's tough, you know. I mean, the big problem you have is teaching to the test, right? You try really hard, you know. There's research that shows that okay, if there's a question A that someone understands narrowly, and you change some small part of it, okay, they're likely to not know how to adjust for that. And so I think that's what we try to do. We try to sort of, you know, with these instruments, they're sort of secret. In fact, I try not to look at the FCI, you know, so as not to sort of be doing that. And the second part of your question was? Yeah, okay. And so there is evidence that when they do these interactive techniques, that it does help the stronger students. It basically helps every contingent of student equally. And these tests are designed to be very, very difficult, right? And so like the one in quantum mechanics, I've been given it now for a few years, I don't think we've ever had a perfect score yet. I mean, it's very, you know, it's designed to sort of have a really high end there to sort of measure people as effectively as possible. So I don't think that happens. But of course, that having those two groups is difficult to contend with, right? Yeah, question up there. Yeah, so I think we try to do it so that person is not involved. Like experiments that I've done here, I've not been associated with that class directly, right? And of course, some of these classes are so huge that, you know, it's difficult. But yeah, that is a difficulty, right? I mean, making sure that no one knows what's happening. So when we do these things, we don't tell the TAs what's happening, you know. And so, but I think this is the key. And we go through ethics review. I've got a lot of ethics review paperwork to try to make sure that it's done as properly as possible. Yeah. I would say there's a much greater... Yeah, well, first of all, I'll say that as far as sub-genres of physics, PER is lauded for its you know, diversity. So I think it is... Yeah, I think right now it's extremely diverse. So that, I think that's a good thing. But I think they're very cognizant of this. You know, one of the great questions we got on this quiz was, what are some of the open questions in PER? And for me, I think number one is, how do we better serve the underrepresented groups? And I don't think there's a really good answer to that yet. And we've been thinking about this for a long time now. And so I think you're right. But I do, you know, I mean, I've only been with the community for a while now, but... Yeah, and I mean, it's difficult, right? Yeah, John. Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, what I do is essentially the same things they did at Illinois in 1997. So I know for what I'm doing, I'm not as concerned with that. But I don't know, it's a good question. I've never seen anybody discuss this. I mean, I think they find these, I mean, part of it is you find these techniques and you're always trying to adjust them and make them better. You know, like I'm sure the sort of smartphone age, I mean, they're going to bring clickers to the smartphone any day now. That's going to change things around, right? Yeah. Said, yeah. Alexandra. Well, I would say that, first of all, I don't find it that way. Okay, but I stole everything that I use, so almost nothing is my own property, right? And I mean, like I said, there's some days where I sometimes don't read. If I've had a really busy day and I got lecture, I'm like, well, you know, we're not gonna do that today. And I sort of use what I already have. I mean, I think what's nice too is that now that I have it, I spend almost no time at all. I look at the answers, you know, an hour before lecture, go over them and make sure there's anything new, but it still gets them to read and gets them to do things. But I think in a case like that, then it would be good to, maybe if you're thinking about this, talk to me, you know, get some advice from me, maybe try to get some TA help for this, maybe try to get, you know, some teaching faculty help for this. You know, maybe if you had seen maybe some of the things I do, maybe that, I don't know, you know, I'm not sure. I didn't find it like that bad, but you know, that was my experience. So maybe, yeah.
Maybe one or two more questions.
Sure.
How much time do you spend on that quiz?
Yeah, that's a good. I mean, when I first did it, the first time I did it, right, it takes some time. And what I've done is I've added things. Like when I did the first time I did it, I did the just-in-time teaching and the clicker questions. And like I said, I basically stole all of those. And I'm sure it's time. I mean, it is true. I have more time to spend on teaching than maybe other people do. And so that's why I think we need ways to help people develop these things and to use them and give them advice and things. But I mean, I don't think it spent that much time. Now, the videos that I did took a lot of time, right? I mean, for one 20-minute video, it's, you know, 2 or 3 hours or something like this. That takes a lot of time. But now that I have them, and I can use them over and over again, right? And so I would not advise that. But it does take time. I mean, but I think it takes time, less time than you think. And the key is I think building a culture where we help each other in doing this, right? And I think if someone was to walk in and want to use some of the stuff for 256, they would have a whole bunch of stuff they could use, and it wouldn't take that much time. But this is, I think, the big issue, and we need to help everybody out with this. I think that's the sort of thing that I'm coming away with, is that we need to find ways to help people so that it's not as much time, so they can still focus on things they need to focus on. Yeah.
Well, let me just make a personal comment that I was in the inaugural class of 256 in 1977. Robin Armstrong actually taught the class. He was chair of the department at the time. And the big deal at the time was that we were teaching quantum mechanics to second-year students. This was seen as being, you know, deep secret that second-year students would not really appreciate or understand. We really should only start in third year. It's actually really inspiring to me, at least, to see how much we've actually gone and pushing the boundaries in terms of getting modern physics to our students using modern techniques. Clearly lots of interest in what you're doing and your colleagues are doing. So perhaps we can all say, Andrew, for the great job.
Thank you so much. Thank you.